Water is fundamental to human development, from drinking water and sanitation to agriculture and more. You listen to Water Stories, a podcast series where you will learn everything about securing water, energy, and food security for all of us. Leaders in the water sector must consider water-related decisions, social, environmental, and economic impacts by integrating community, biodiversity, science, financial, health, nature-based solutions, and also political perspective. In this episode, we will have as a guest to discuss a little bit about leadership and sustainability related to water. Once again, I am sharing microphones as a co-host with Vishal Mehta, an environmental scientist with more than 15 years of experience in water research at the Stockholm Environment Institute. He's based in Davis, California. Vishal, how are you?
I'm very good today, JC, and glad to co-host with you. This is our last episode of season 2, and especially happy to welcome Camille Kirk. She is the Director of Campus Sustainability Planning at the University of California, right here in Davis. And we started working with Camille on local groundwater planning and management, I think more than a decade ago, and we've stayed in touch. She is, like I said, the director of the Davis Campus Sustainability Office, has 15 years in that position, but tons of experience in environmental planning before that. And to add to what you said, we really want to highlight the role of leadership in sustainability, especially of women leaders. So it's especially fitting to welcome Camille today.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here. I'm very excited for this conversation.
Oh, thank you so much, Camille. It's an honor to have you today as a guest. Camille, to get into the context, according to Green Metrics Rankings in 2021, UC Davis maintains its ranking as the most sustainable university in North America and the fifth most sustainable university in the world. In your role as Director Campus Sustainability Planner at UC Davis University, what do you think about leadership in the sustainable sector, and what are the challenges institutions or entities usually face related to leadership?
That's a fantastic question. I often get asked, how does UC Davis, what are we doing to get ourselves to this level in these rankings, and how do we convince our leadership to support sustainability actions? And I would say, I'm partly privileged to be working for an institution that has sustainability essentially baked into its DNA, but I will also say that one of the very big challenges in sustainability, in really anything difficult, is engagement, sustained engagement. So how do you get all levels of your community, including your senior leadership, all the way through, you know, the man on the street who may not be thinking very much about the thing that I'm passionate about, sustainability, but how do I engage and get these people involved, committed to, supportive, wanting to take personal action, wanting to take institutional action? So for me, the biggest challenge of sustainability is continuous engagement. And I recently was explaining, it was a different sustainability topic, not water, it was climate change and climate action. But I was making the case that this is really about playing the long game. So you're going to hear no so many times, and you need to listen to why that no is being said. You need to ask a lot of questions. You need to get to root on why are you being told no right now? What is it that's the, what's the fear? What's the concern? Why do people not feel like they can take action towards making something more sustainable? And being able to address those concerns and help people see that by allying with you and allying with the thing that you're trying to get done, they'll get what they need to get done too, that you will help them while they help you. That is, I think, one of the most important ways to be able to take action in a sustainable way and towards a more sustainable institution, whatever that institution may be, a campus, a museum, local or regional or national government, a nonprofit, any of these levels and layers, you really need that sustained engagement.
Yes, it's a wonderful way of describing it as a long game, thinking about sustainability and working on sustainability. And I see a lot of parallels with Camille and what she said with SEI's own work in the places that we work. And to be able to do sustained engagement in this field, how does that come about? That's one of the biggest questions for nonprofits, especially if you're working overseas in project mode. That's something that I personally struggle with. Now, since we are based in California, we're able to do that in California, for example, with our DWR work and with the Department of Water Resources, the State Water Resources Board. You know, we have like some 20 years of credible work here. And that's how we sustain our mission. And that's what I started thinking is that, you know, Camille, you are in this position for 15 years. Can you describe, you know, how it's been, how have things changed over those 15 years of sustained engagement, as you said? And also, like, step back and describe what is the Campus Sustainability Office and what drove it to be formed? How has it changed? What kind of roles you play there? And has it changed over all these years?
I love it. Yeah, it's that's a bit of an origin story. So I guess I would start by saying it certainly has evolved. You're absolutely right, Vishal. Being here in California, we're so fortunate because we have a lot of structure around us that really supports this work. Legislative structure, regulatory structure, cultural structure that very much undergirds, underpins this work. It would be very different if we were in a different state in the U.S., maybe, I won't say, but maybe, you know, another state or another country. I totally acknowledge the privilege that we have here in the state because of the structure that really supports the work. That said, it's definitely a journey, and we've been on that journey at UC Davis. And I think a lot of it has to do with, in the case of the University of California, a few things. First of all, students were really important. So I think one of the great joys of being in higher education is that you are basically working with the future all the time, because students that come through, you know, it's a little bit portrait of Dorian Gray, right? Like, we're all getting older, but the students, they're all, most of them are still in the same age band. And so you're really experiencing the future all the time when you're in a higher education setting, because you know that these are the young people who are being trained to go out and they're going to be leaders. They're going to make a difference in their community. I'm going to touch on education. I know we're going to get into women in water a little bit later, and there's a point I want to make about education with that. But so one of the things that I think is really key is that we had student leadership in the early 2000s that really pushed us to have some policy, sustainable practices policy in the University of California. The students rightfully made the case to the Board of Regents, which is like our Board of Trustees or our governorship. They oversee the management of the university, the full University of California system. And the students in the early 2000s made the case that, you know, we do all this research and we do all this teaching on sustainability efforts, but then what are we actually doing in our operations? How are we operationally being sustainable? How are we walking the talk? And it was a fantastic point. The Board of Regents were able to hear it. And they said, we think that it would be a good idea for the University of California to develop a policy. And that policy has grown. It's very much a living, breathing, very actively stewarded, very actively implemented policy. And having that policy has been very important. Having that student leadership's been very important. It certainly has been a journey of evolution. And I would say the other thing, then I go back again to the engagement. Part of the story of the way things have evolved, not just at UC, but at UC Davis, but across the University of California, has really been about making sustainability a really big tent and inviting many, many stakeholders in and pointing to people who might not see themselves as rightful stakeholders in the project of making a more sustainable higher education institution, pointing and showing them like that you do have a vested interest in our sustainability, and here's how. And helping them then see that and then articulate the case themselves. And then, as one of my colleagues here at UC Davis has said, if you're always the only person in the room talking about your issue, then your issue is not going to be important and you're not going to get it very far down the road. But if other people are talking about your issue because it's also their issue, then you're going to get where you need to go. And so one of the things that we've done at UC Davis is sustainability is lots of people's issue. It's not just my issue. It's not just my office's issue. My office is, you know, it's got three important roles. We are there to help demonstrate leadership and help people, you know, make connections. And we're there to help measure our performance in sustainability and then use that performance assessment really strategically to drive the next sets of actions, to drive the next sets of engagement campaigns, so that we're creating this virtuous circle around engagement, performance assessment, leadership actions, and getting other people to see why this is their issue, not just my issue, or not just my office's issue.
Camille, you just mentioned two important words, is implementing and engage. And I think both are related with the Sustainable Development Goals and education as well. In May 2021, you were part of UC Davis Forum on the UN SDGs panel. And one of the points you mentioned in the forum is to track the SDG activities. So let's talk a little bit about water, you know, which is the SDGs number 6. In your opinion, what progress have you observed about this essential sustainable goal, which is ensure the ability and sustainable water and sanitation for all of us?
Well, first of all, I will say that I am a massive fan of the UN Sustainable Development Goals, in part because they do what something that we've been struggling for a while to do in the United States, which is to really remember that social sustainability and environmental sustainability are coupled. They're joined at the hip. You cannot have a healthy planet. I love to say this. Vishal's heard me say this. You cannot have a healthy planet without justly and equitably served people, and you cannot bring justice and equity to people. You cannot have a just and equitable world for people if you don't have also a healthy planet. So they go hand in hand. And the UN Sustainable Development Goals inherently make that case. And that is what, for me, is so powerful and strong about them. We've been doing a lot of really interesting work together. It's a very unique partnership at UC Davis. There are not very many examples of this kind of partnership in the United States. There are some in other parts of the world, particularly Latin America seems to be more focused this way. But we have done a big partnership between our Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion office and our Global Affairs office with our Sustainability office. And the three offices have looked at different ways that we can really advance awareness of, engagement with, and action on the 2030 agenda, the Sustainable Development Goals. One of the things that we did with these SDG forums was try to highlight different researchers and students and staff and teaching faculty who are actively doing work that intersects somehow with one or more of the Sustainable Development Goals. We also undertook a voluntary university review to explore and uncover how we are advancing across all 17 of the goals, work at UC Davis in teaching, in research, in our service work, and also operationally. So in our physical plant operations, what are we doing to implement and advance the agenda in a way that is relevant to and appropriate at a higher education institution? So of course, you know, the SDGs, they're really written in ways with metrics that are sort of a national level. So then you have to kind of downscale or translate those metrics into something that's meaningful for a smaller region or an institution, right? So you see examples of voluntary local reviews where cities or counties are exploring their connections and advancement of the Sustainable Development Goals. And then in our case, we pulled together an analysis, one of only two that we know of in the United States. The other one, a few months ahead of us, was Carnegie Mellon University, where we were looking at how, as I mentioned, how we were implementing and acting on the 17 different goals. In terms of water at UC Davis, well, we have a formidable depth of research, absolutely formidable. And Vishal is way more an authority on this than I am. But it's quite amazing the types of work, the breadth of work on all things hydrological at UC Davis. That's across things like the use of water in agriculture, groundwater, surface and groundwater interactions, water and equity, water and energy. We have a water energy institute that looks at the water energy nexus. So there's an incredible, expansive, both broad and deep pool of research and thinking at UC Davis. In terms of operations, we've also done quite a lot to advance the resiliency of our water supplies, think about how to engage our campus community in conservation actions, and then undertake infrastructure actions that both result in greater resiliency and also greater conservation.
Camille, could you describe for our listeners some specific examples in that realm of water conservation on the demand side and the supply side, especially in the context, as you know, of the deep droughts and prolonged droughts we've been having in California? How does that affect the campus, and how has water use and management changed over all these years that you've been the director there?
Yeah, well, it's not just me. Okay, so long before I ever got to UC Davis, we were already beginning water conservation actions. So one of the interesting things is that we still use about the same amount of water as we did in the late 1960s, and our population has tripled. Our campus population has tripled in that time. So an amazing decrease in per capita water use. And so that's a big kudo to us. A lot of it has to do with the very typical things you might imagine, like water conservation, water conserving fixtures, doing things like creating cooling loops instead of using single pass cooling for equipment. So what does that mean? It means we have a chilled water loop on campus, and instead of maybe, say, an autoclave being attached to what amounts to the faucet and water goes through it to cool it down and then goes out into the drain, we're sending that water back into the chilled water loop, where it's then joining the full campus chilled water loop as opposed to just getting rejected into the sanitary sewer. Other things are a lot of work on retrofitting our landscape, which actually is an interesting story that has intersections with climate change, intersections with the economic side of sustainability. So we've written this living landscape adaptation plan, and we're beginning to implement a landscape shift on campus away from plantings that were appropriate for the climate that we had in the 20th century, and we're getting ready for plantings that will be appropriate for the latter half of the 21st and the beginning of the 22nd century, where we know that we're going to be more like, you know, based on the climate science and the downscaled regional climate change projections for our area, we know we're going to be more like Phoenix. So we're looking for plantings and landscape shifts on campus that respect the climate change and also respect the fact that we need to use less water on the landscape. We've been working with people on, and it's really small, right? Like, people washing their hands is not the main reason why we're in a drought. And drought is a human term, of course, too, right? Like, droughts matter to humans. Sustainability matters to humans. The planet's the planet. If we're at a deep ecology conversation, then, you know, things will go on, whatever. But this all matters because we're people. And so for people, drought matters. For people, sustainability matters. And one of the things that we're trying to do is get people just to be aware of their water use and be mindful. And so we have different programs like Green Workplace, where we teach people, you know, if you're in a lab, here's a way to wash your lab wear that uses less water and still gets your lab wares clean, maybe even cleaner than the old way that you used to, you know, just like literally dump it in a bucket and turn the water on and let the water run. So doing things like that, where we're both engaging people at the small, modest personal actions, which still add up, and I don't want to sound like I'm minimizing those, it does matter. And at the same time, you know, making big infrastructure shifts. And you also mentioned, Vishal, you wanted to know what we were doing on supply. So we're a very interesting, quirky, unique UC. No other UC is like us. So we have a huge agricultural program. So we apply a lot of water for our agricultural teaching and research fields. And we're beginning to explore ways to be more conservative in the amount of water that we use on our research fields. And we also have a big aquaculture program. And so we've done things like put variable frequency drives on our well pumps. So it's not just like a continuous flow. It's like cycling when it needs to maintain the correct temperature for the fish. We've, in terms of supply, we have two surface water supplies. One of them is a beautiful regional partnership with two cities. Another is a partnership and a participation in another collaborative water, the Solano Water Project collaborative water management effort. And then we also have groundwater. We do pump from aquifers. And so we are also part of the Yolo Subbasin Groundwater Management Agency. And that's another incredible conversation and example of collaborative, supportive water management, understanding that, you know, we're all in this together.
Interesting, Camille, because what you just described involves a lot of people, you know, stakeholders. So speaking about stakeholders, I would like to bring up the topic of women and water. So the Stockholm Environment Institute recently shared an article, "The Next Water Action Agenda Must Be Gender Transformative." What do you think about the role of women in water?
Well, first of all, thanks for bringing that up, because I read that article and I would just want to say it was fantastic. I was really impressed by it, really liked what I was reading, was very excited to see it, was a little bit disheartened that it's taken us basically half a century to bring up gender again in water, but somehow also not surprised. I think, you know, again, I go back to the Sustainable Development Goals, gender equality, goal 5, right next door to goal 6, clean water. I guess I would say I'm very excited at the prospect of the world bringing in a gender transformative perspective to conversations on water and, frankly, all other sustainability challenges. Many years ago in college, I wrote a paper for one of my geography classes in which I postulated that education was absolutely transformative as an environmental strategy, an environmental preservation strategy. Specifically education of women, because when you educate women, you give them a lot more tools to then advocate for themselves and to make change in their communities. And because women generally tend to make change for their communities, this turns out to be a really fantastic strategy. So educating women, I would say, should also be at the heart of any discussion of a gender transformative agenda for any, you know, topical area, be it water or climate change or, you know, food or whatever, all of which, by the way, have intersections. I mean, you know, you pull a string of the sweater and the whole sweater starts falling apart, right? But I think that it's really important for us to go to the point that was made in that great SEI article of it's important to avoid the stereotypes of women in water, like, oh, women go and get the water from the well, or women go and get the wood or whatever. Yes, yes, that's true. But it's also these really structural political challenges that we need to address head on. Why are these gender roles here? What does it mean? How can you safely have a conversation about these gender roles and not undermine anyone and not create fear and not create resistance because of fear by having conversations around changing gender roles or giving women the ability to tackle some of these structural challenges, which inherently means men have to be there helping with that, right? You're not going to get very far if men aren't part of this conversation and agreeing to these changes, right? And so you have to find out how can we undertake change that brings men along too, while also advancing women and then holistically full communities and regions.
Thanks, Camille. On the subject of women leaders, do you think much has changed since when you started 15 years ago in your position? Do you see still underlying challenges for the development of women leaders? And do you also see positive sides, at least, in the kinds of forum that you work with?
I think that there are some, I think it's interesting to see how many women are mid-management or foot soldiers in the sustainability movement, and frequently men are still the big boss, if you will. I think that's starting to change some, but I do think that that is still something I would observe. I also think that there is sometimes a sense that sustainability is a woman's issue. It's just, you know, it's so nurturing, it's so caring, you know, it's little fluffy kind of thing, you know. And I think breaking out of that is really important. That said, I am an optimist generally at heart, and what I see from the upcoming generations is really, for the most part, an openness to asking a lot of questions about those gender-based roles, about gender-based assumptions, about gender. And really, I think that there is, I'm excited for the future. I think however many hard challenges we have in front of us, and my goodness, we do, I do feel though that the upcoming generations are, they just are they're open to asking questions that were hard for my generation to ask, maybe didn't even occur to us to ask. And so that for me is super exciting. I think that there will continue to be evolution in the sustainability sector. I think women in leadership positions, they can be leaders. You know, we see this in politics, right? Women are just as good at fundraising. They're just as good at campaigning. They just need to actually put their hat in the ring. So a lot of what I do with the young women who I try to mentor or be a good role model for is just to remind them that you need to get out there and you just got to put your hat in the ring. Like, you're going to get knocked down. There'll be times where people don't want you or you'll annoy them or whatever. And you need to, you know, understand what happened there, but you need to not brood on it. You need to move forward and you need to get out there and be in the mix. And I think the more that women do that, the likelier we are to have more women leaders in sustainability and in all the other realms that women can be leaders in. I'll leave it at that.
Camille, you know, speaking about asking questions, yesterday I attend a event hosted by S&P Global, and the title of this event was Beyond ESG with Financial Impacts of Droughts and Water Scarcity. And the host asked to attendees a very interesting question. Does your organization currently manage water risk? And the answer were yes, 35%, no, 40%, and starting some kind of a strategy, 25%. So I would like to know your opinion. Why do some organizations still have some problems addressing these issues in water?
That's a great question. My daughter did an internship with Ceres this past year in 2022, and she's in college, and she worked on water risk. It was super interesting to hear her talk about what she was finding and looking at corporate, you know, sustainability reporting, what were people doing. I think part of it is that, you know, we like to say we use this bromide. Well, let me be very careful about this. For some people, they're very serious. They're deadly serious when they say water is life. And they really do understand what that means. For others, I think it's an easy thing to say without having to do the hard work that goes behind that. And that's partly because I think that in so many places, and definitely in the United States, water is way too cheap. In capitalist economies, we respond to price signals. And I think that one of the things that's happened is that people haven't felt, corporations have not necessarily experienced the economic risk yet of water. And as that becomes more and more important, and as we see greater increase in water risk tied both to climate change and also just to the increasing challenges around clean water access and what it means politically and in a corporate governance structure to have reasonable access to water, mindful of the equity and justice, environmental justice issues around access to that water, I think that will start to drive the change. I think that this is one of those areas where people are beginning to wake up to it. And again, it's enough of a slow roll, just like climate change is. It feels like something that you can delay a little bit and figure it out, because meantime you've got some other like immediate fire that you've got to put out, right? Some sort of corporate crisis that you're trying to deal with. And this water and climate change feels slow, even though they're really coming on us quite fast. I think to answer your question, it's because water just hasn't been a big enough problem yet. And as it becomes a bigger problem for corporations, they'll pay attention more.
Actually, there's a fascinating article I was reading just out of the EU, where there's a survey of many corporations and an assessment of water risk across the board, across maybe thousands of corporations. So I'll share that with you too, and provide a link to interested listeners when this podcast comes out. But essentially in the EU, corporations are beginning to really seriously take into account water as risks and opportunities. And the other thing that I was reminded about in terms of the reference to costs of water, I think that basically people's lived experiences really matter a lot. So for example, if you live in a water scarce environment, then your relationship to water is very immediate. And if you don't live in those conditions, then it's not. So the farming community anywhere in the world is very tightly connected with thinking about water all the time, and they relate to it differently. And the third thing I wanted to say, listening to Camille, was that what we really are not able to track very well is virtual water. So the water that's carried from one place to another through, say, food exports and imports, and even through all kinds of other commodities and products through global trade or trade within a country. And that's, I think, something that's really we have not got a handle on how to even estimate, except in very specific cases, and how to monitor, and then how are we going to regulate, which then brings me to a couple of things that Camille has mentioned throughout this conversation. Is you started off mentioning voluntary agreements and leadership that came from the students, from bottom up, Camille. And we haven't talked too much about regulations except through your reference to the Groundwater Act, for example. So where do you see regulations in terms of playing a role in managing ourselves in a more sustainable fashion?
That's a great question. I just have to follow up on a couple of points that you made. Again, you know, referencing one of your earlier podcasts with your colleague, Claudia, the teleconnection of water. I think I love your idea of how could we measure virtual water. And immediately what popped into my head was like something like a Sankey diagram. And I just think, I don't know exactly how to manifest that, but I think it would be so interesting. So interesting. Like I was thinking about, you know, her point that, or no, JC, I think it was your point that 40% of the coffee consumed in the United States comes from Colombia, or we consume 40% yes. of Colombia's coffee, or so. I can't remember which way the figure went. But I thought immediately, I was like, wow, we're drinking the water of Colombia, and we don't even really think about that. And that then started my head spinning, like, oh my gosh, what other water do I consume? Like molecules of water that I don't really think about, you know? I consume Mexican water when I consume fruit from Mexico. Like, right, there's all these moments where you're like, oh, I don't think about the water that I take from other places necessarily.
Or it is because water is borderless.
Yeah, exactly. It is, right? And so I think if you saw this idea of the virtual water tracking, that's super interesting. Some regulator out there, if you're listening to this, that would be something to noodle on and think about what you might do there. I hate to postulate where regulation is going because I feel like I'll never get that one right. But I do think that overall, incorporating more of the economic risk into valuation, things like what the SEC is doing with the Scope 3 disclosure rule, I think more of that is going to be in our future vis-a-vis water. I suspect that there will be, I'm still hung up on the virtual water thing. I think that would be a really interesting regulatory conundrum to unravel. But I suspect there will be a lot more, one hopes it will be collaborative, one really hopes it won't be combative, work around shared water boundaries and shared water bodies. So wherever you see national boundaries along rivers, where you see shared water management,
that's a good point.
Subnational, I'm thinking of the US and then the Western US. I think there's a lot there that's going to unfold for us with climate change changing our precipitation patterns. I think that that will also be something that will be interesting to see, is with changes to the way we've historically experienced precipitation and managed precipitation due to climate change, what will that mean for us in terms of new regulation that's needed to manage, be they things like reservoirs or capturing water in aquifers, recapturing it like Woodland is doing with their aquifer storage. I don't know. I think there's a lot to come, and it,
I think I also, you know, and your point, sharing water, for example, between companies, let's see, PepsiCo with Coke, they can share. I don't know. It came to my mind right now, you know?
Yeah.
This is the right way to do, mm-hmm. I guess, because as you mentioned, probably right now they don't feel in the situation, but in the years to come, is going to be more scarcity. So probably splitting or sharing, you know, will be a nice idea.
Yeah, I mean, it's that one's so, that's a really interesting example, JC. It's hard to wrap one's mind around two deep competitors figuring out how to collaborate on something like water supply and also do it with an equity and justice lens, respecting national, subnational, and local governments, right? That one's an interesting one to wrap your head around.
Let's see what they say. Camille, before wrapping up, is there anything that you would like to add that just came to your mind that you would like to share with our audience right now?
No, I other than just to say, I think water is one of the most fascinating political and yet basic elemental things that we grapple with as humans. Vishal, I also really want to back up your point that you made about people's relationship to water has a lot to do with their lived experience with water. And I'm thinking when you said that, my mind immediately flashed to recently I was in a place where the water in the restroom in my hotel room was not potable. And I'm so used to being able to, in the United States, I turn on the bathroom tap. I don't think a thing about sticking my toothbrush under it. And it was one of these moments where I had to be very thoughtful and mindful of my relationship to water in a way that I don't always have to be when I live in the United States. And so it was, I want to say, thank you for bringing that up, because I do think our lived experience with water is super important. And it is something I hope that people carry with them when they are using water or thinking about using water and hopefully make very good choices.
Vishal, is there anything that you would like to add?
Well, I did have one last question for Camille. I mean, there's a lot that I would like to talk with you about, Camille. So, you know, when we meet, we can chat. But one last thing I would like to ask you for this podcast is, you know, what directions would you like to steer UCD in your position in the short term and also in the long term?
That's a great question. So as you know, as I said earlier, I believe in playing the long game. So one of the things that we're going to be doing is incorporating the UN Sustainable Development Goals into our update of the Water Action Plan that mm-hmm. we have for UC Davis. So every UC campus has a Water Action Plan. We call ours our Drought Response Action Plan because that's such a big driver for us. Putting that lens of social sustainability and environmental justice into a water action plan will be really interesting to work on and prompt some interesting conversations at UC Davis. So I'm looking forward to that. And that's sort of short to midterm. Long term, we're working, you know, across the campus with multiple stakeholders involved in building a surface water treatment plant for Solano Water Project water on our campus. And I think that's helping us increase our resilience and extending our different supplies. That's a longer game action because it will need to be done in you know, stair steps along the way. And I think I'm excited for us to continue to think about how do we invest in our infrastructure? How do we invest in our management of that infrastructure? So things like leak detection, and how do we invest in our built environment? So things like our landscape in ways that position us to be resilient and yet still be vibrant and thrive and have a beautiful campus. And make sure that we're thinking about equity and about environmental justice for not just our campus community, but our extended community. And how do we continue to collaborate and partner with all of our regional stakeholders, various jurisdictions and agencies and the people that we share the beautiful Yolo County with? How will we continue to collaborate, deepen those collaborations, and extend those partnerships in mutually beneficial ways that allow us all to thrive? So I spend time thinking about that and look forward to continuing to do that.
I agree with you, Camille. I think collaboration, co-creation, and thinking in the long term is crucial to getting, you know, the real impact. Camille, where can people reach you? And also, please feel free to share any kind of, you know, information that our audience would like to know about what you and your organization are doing.
Oh, thank you for asking. So you can, people can find me on LinkedIn, but you can also find out more about what we're doing at UC Davis if you go to sustainability.ucdavis.edu. And we have more detailed information and our plans and things like that up on our website. And there's also, under the About Us section, there's a way to contact me directly so people can find me that way. And thank you for asking.
No, sure. Vishal.
Thanks, Kabil. I think it's been a fitting finale to season 2 of Water Stories. I really look forward to our interactions going forward. I've really enjoyed doing this podcast with you, JC, and I hope we can do another season as well. And I want to wish you both happy St. Patrick's Day tomorrow.
Here in Boston, at least, it's going to be
fun. Yes.
Yeah.
Certainly. Camille, thank you so much for your time. I really enjoyed this conversation, and Vishal as well. I really enjoy and learn a lot from you guys, and thank you so much.
And thank you so much. It was an honor and a pleasure to be here, so thank you again for inviting me.
Thank you so much for listening to this second season of Water Stories. Remember, it's available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Google Podcasts. Thank you so much, everyone.